Welcome to the Free to Be More podcast by the Enoch Pratt Free Library. I'm your host, Megan McCorkle. This podcast series features conversations with leaders and innovators having a positive impact in our city. Let's get started. Your journey starts here. Making the way for more affordable housing in Maryland and developing strong communities. It's the mission for Jake Day, Maryland Secretary of Housing and Community Development. We'll talk to him about how he's working with Governor Wes Moore to invest in communities so there's a brighter future here in Baltimore and beyond. Secretary Jake Day, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Megan. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, for people who are not familiar with your role, what is the role of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development?
That's a great question. I always describe the department as the state's housing and place-based economic development entity. And so we do two things. One, you know, we are part of the executive branch. So I'm an advisor to the governor. You could think of me like the chief housing officer for the governor. But number two is we're a lending institution. We're a bank. We do significant economic development work through grant making and even more so through lending in a number of different ways, from mortgages to development finance to small business loans.
So you have been in the position, I guess, over a year now, right, under Governor Wes Moore. What are some of the biggest accomplishments you feel like your office has made that you're most proud of for the state?
Well, look, I want to be clear. You know, I came to this agency, of course, proud to work for Governor Moore, proud to be a part of his team. But I also, I knew this agency. I mean, I'd received grants and benefits in my hometown from this organization. So I knew the impact it could have. And I knew that I was taking charge of an entity that was in great shape, that was healthy. And I have been so impressed by the people that I found here. But I want to say that I am so proud of the ways in which we have added to and redesigned the organization and kept what was working and I think added some really important functions to become a thought leader on housing. You know, there were so many conversations happening on housing that weren't including us, that we weren't at the table for. Mm-hmm. And that was a loss not only for us, but it was a loss for those working to advance housing objectives in this state. So that's number one. Number two, we had in the last year had almost $2.5 billion in direct impact in state, accounting for over $17 billion in total impact on the state. So we're really proud of what we do as an economic development and community development agency.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a little bit about your background. I know you grew up in Salisbury with the mayor of Salisbury. Talk to me a little bit about your background and how you wound up in this political sphere and then working for Governor Wes Moore.
Yeah. So, you know, you said it. I was born and raised in Salisbury on Maryland's Eastern Shore, the capital of the Eastern Shore, we call ourselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, loved my community, was proud of it, wanted to make it better. And so I got involved as first, you know, in some volunteer roles as a planning commissioner and in other roles, eventually, reluctantly, but eventually ran for office to become city council president and then later did two terms as mayor. And I did not at any point in time seek to become the housing mayor, but I have often been called that. I sought to make a better community for my residents. And one of the ways in which they're struggling is with housing affordability. And so the work that we did on that front, I think, caught some attention. I think there were a lot of things that we were doing in Salisbury that caught attention statewide. And that was one of them. And it led me to this position. So Governor Moore, you know, who was then a candidate for governor, came to Salisbury and had an event, and I joined him, and we just got to talking and texting, and eventually decided to say, you know, I'd like to be part of the team. And so I went through the formal process, and somehow, some way, I ended up joining the team in the role as Secretary of Housing.
What has it meant to you to go from focused on housing in one city in Maryland to then looking at the issue across the whole state? How do you even take in that scope?
Well, we've got a really diverse state, so not every community is going to see things the same way. And I'm experiencing that right now as we debate and discuss the governor's housing priorities, three pieces of legislation that the General Assembly is reviewing right now and working toward adopting into law. And so I think I'm reminded that I don't have the same view of every community that I had of Salisbury because it was mine and I knew it. And so I do a lot of listening and a lot of learning. We do these things called day trips where we travel around the state and spend time in each county and each community, learning what their visions and their objectives are. I want to say, generally speaking, I view my job as resourcing the visions and priorities of local communities, cities, towns, counties, not coming up with visions for them. And so we support those objectives. We also support overall objectives of the state, which sometimes are in conflict with how one local elected official might feel. And so we do have conflict that we have to work through. But I go back to my time as one of them, as a mayor, as a council president, and even my time as president of the Maryland Municipal League to say, you know what? I may not know your community as well as you know it, but I do understand what you're dealing with. And I understand your vantage point because I occupied that same vantage point for a very long time. And I think it's led to a lot of collegiality and a lot of compromise where we found a lot of common ground in recent months.
When you talk about that conflict across the state, we are seeing a housing shortage, but in some places, we see resistance in communities to build affordable housing. So how are you working to kind of overcome that stigma and build high quality affordable housing?
This is one of the most important tasks that is facing me today, and that's facing our development community, our legislators, our governor, and beyond. We have, I think, in society, two real challenges that are difficult to overcome. And one of them is that human beings don't like change. We just don't like change. We're just completely uncomfortable with it. Mm-hmm. We're all excited about the idea of progress and growth and things moving forward. And when I say growth, I'm not talking about, that's not a euphemism for real estate development. I mean, you know, we're excited for things to get better, bigger, have more abundance and resources. That's what we like, but we don't like the process of getting there as humans. And so that's a real challenge for all of us. And it's one that's difficult to adopt a policy or design a program to counteract. Mm-hmm. There is no messaging strategy that changes human nature. So that's number one. Number two is that we have done a terrible job as government over American history, particularly the last 70 years or so, a terrible job endearing people to government intervention in housing. Uh-huh. When we have built housing that the government owned, we built garbage. Yep. And when we have not owned housing and instead used vouchers and other tools to help subsidize people's housing costs, we have concentrated poverty. We have told people that we didn't want to do it, but we had to. And so we've ended up subsidizing, you know, things that that concentrate poverty, and rather than lending our efforts toward the outcomes that we espouse, which is recognizing that kids have a better life when they are around people with different socioeconomic backgrounds than themselves, when they're in mixed income communities, when neither wealth nor poverty are concentrated. So how do we counteract that? Well, I think we have designed some good policy solutions to addressing that second issue. The Governor's Housing Expansion and Affordability Act, one of the things that it does is it requires that those who benefit from building more dense housing, that those who will benefit from adding more market rate housing units must, they're required to integrate affordability into it. When we do that, when we say out of the gate, we're going to have mixed income development, we're going to naturally end up with more socioeconomically diverse communities. And that ultimately is our goal.
When we discuss the sort of community development side of what your office does, kind of beyond just housing, infrastructure in general is aging. I know specifically here in Baltimore City, police stations, rec centers, and certainly libraries here are struggling to maintain infrastructure and buildings. So how vital is it to also consider the redevelopment of these resources as you're working to build housing in these communities?
It's absolutely critical, Megan. There are a number of ways in which we get to have a role in those efforts. Number one, we have something called State Revitalization Programs, which is a very large grant program where through a number of different pools, we award funds to local governments, to community development organizations, and even to the EDS and MEDS anchor institutions to help them with community development objectives. And it can be everything from private commercial development. So, you know, supporting, you know, building the corner store or, you know, shopping center to housing development, to community institutions like the library and community center and even town halls and police stations. So we support that with grant funds. We also support it with something called the Local Government Infrastructure Financing Program. So we can actually lend money into those projects that local government needs assistance with. And then lastly, in the governor's Housing and Community Development Financing Act this year, we're establishing something called the Maryland Community Investment Corporation, which is a vehicle for new markets tax credits to bring federal dollars in to build those very community institutions that we're talking about.
Imagination Celebration returns to the Enoch Pratt Free Library. April is a month full of magical events at all Pratt branches for our youngest customers. Stop by your library to pick up a free imagination kit while supplies last. More details at prattlibrary.org.
How will that program look? How does that work if it is passed in the General Assembly?
Yeah, if that's passed, and that's just one facet of that bill, but it'll stand up a new entity. This will be a governor-appointed board, but a quasi-independent entity, meaning it'll have its own staff. And on that board will be the comptroller, the Secretary of Housing, the Secretary of Commerce, and two residents of low-income neighborhoods representing low-income neighborhoods and nonprofits. And so the five-member board will be responsible for hiring an executive director and staff and the lawyers and accountants necessary to build a U.S. Treasury certified community development entity, which is what the MCIC would be. And that entity then will go select projects in lower income neighborhoods in Maryland and support those projects by leveraging new markets tax credits for equity investors to put money into revitalization efforts. And there are a couple of entities that do that kind of work in Maryland today, but we underperform as a state, and we certainly want to bring in every federal dollar that we possibly can.
One of the places that those federal dollars can play into with the new market tax credits are these like sort of public-private partnerships that we're seeing to be more key in urban redevelopment. How do you think, specifically in Baltimore, those can be leveraged?
There are some great examples in Baltimore. I mean, I think about, there's just a CDE that is working on the old Crown Cork and Seal factory building, or buildings, I should say, campus in Baltimore City. These are huge properties that a lot of post-industrial cities have. Baltimore's not alone, but they're underutilized or unutilized in some cases. And it's going to take tens of millions of dollars to redevelop them. And that money is not just going to appear. There's not going to be a good-hearted private investor that's going to just show up with dollars. There's got to be some benefit. And the new markets tax credits offer them a benefit. And you pair that with state historic tax credits, you pair that with some of our grant funds, and all of a sudden you've closed the gaps in these deals for what can be not just huge liabilities on a city like Baltimore, but instead could be catalytic revitalization projects.
One model I know that you're familiar with, specifically with libraries, sort of co-locating spaces with affordable housing, is in Johnston Square here in Baltimore City, an upcoming project where a library will be put in the first floor of the building with apartments on top of it. How is that type of project really a win-win for the community, and how can it be transformative?
I can think of few better examples of win-wins than libraries integrated into urban redevelopment that includes housing. Just a little bit south of Baltimore in Rockville and in Silver Spring and in Wheaton, there have been efforts to, and successfully in two of those cases, redevelop parts of a downtown area with housing above a library. And what you end up with is not only a built-in kind of captive audience for the library, you end up with a great mix of drivers of street life. The reason why you see so many central business districts diversifying is not just because telecommuting and the pandemic has changed the office market, but also because you extend the day. You extend the day for retail shops, for those storefronts. You extend life on the street when you add housing. You know, the person that is going home to their apartment after work is the same one who might want to go out to dinner. You know, they're on the street in the evenings in such a way that the office worker who has left a central business district at 5 p.m. is not. And I think the library is a great counterpoint to that too, because library activities, I can tell you from our own downtown library in Salisbury, library activities are heightened in evenings and weekends and summers, times when the schools are closed. And those are all times when central business districts are quieter. So I think there's a great complementary use between libraries and housing, and the urban model with one over the other is a really exciting prospect.
You've touched on it a little bit, talking about telecommuting and things like that. The impact that the COVID pandemic had specifically on urban downtown business districts is kind of undeniable. How do you see that shifting policy over the next few years, where we are seeing these buildings that used to be really filled with business workers now sitting empty in a lot of our urban areas or partially empty?
Well, I hope we have learned, thanks to COVID, that we shouldn't try to predict the future, because it's going to surprise us. and so while I'm not going to sit here and say the era of large office blocks is over, because something will change and cause it to come back. But that being said, for the foreseeable future, and I think in general, hindsight being 2020, we know that we should have better integrated uses and not been so prone as Americans when building our cities to segregate uses. So residential, commercial, office, and retail. I think when we integrate those things, we lead to a more rich environment. We lead to more successful places. And you know, look at the most vibrant parts of our country, and that's very true in those places. Now, obviously, zoning plays an important role in protecting life, safety, and health and wellness. And we shouldn't be putting factories in the middle of residential neighborhoods. But that's just not the case when it comes to integrating some of the uses that we're talking about. So what do I see from a policy standpoint? I view that we will create tools and resurrect tools that were designed in the pandemic era to try to fill vacant spaces. And we'll have new tools that we have to create that are oriented on helping to reuse office space into something else. Those things are not going to be necessarily one size fits all. I think what works for a 20-story office building or a former hotel in downtown Baltimore is going to be different from what works on the second and third floor of a downtown building in Easton, Maryland. You know, I think they're going to require different things, but we're starting to have conversations with those building owners and those community leaders to design policy solutions that work for addressing, you know, fire suppression costs for the second and third floor in a small town downtown building versus what kind of maybe tax credits or incentives are required to recapitalize a large office building and turn it into residential.
The bulk of our listeners are in Baltimore, and the governor has said, you know, this is Maryland's decade, but for that to happen, it's really got to be Baltimore's time. Baltimore faces a lot of unique urban development challenges. And from your perspectives, what are some of those key issues that Baltimore is facing, and how can your department play a part in helping in the solutions of those issues?
I think from where I sit, there are two existential questions that Baltimore must answer, and or problems that Baltimore must solve. One is its population loss, which has the effect of producing vacancy all over the city, and we're all aware of that. And the second is a more acute one, and it's what is the role of the waterfront, particularly Harbor Place? And Baltimore's in the midst of trying to answer that question right now. I think that on that second one, Baltimore has as good an answer as I have seen in a long time in what's proposed for the waterfront. Now, I realize there are going to be lots of opinions on architecture and on urban design. As an urban designer and architect, I have my opinions. But I think it's incumbent upon the city to figure that out and to attract people back to the waterfront in a way that, you know, maybe Harbor Place hasn't in recent memory. But on the first, on vacancy and the effect of population decline, there are buyers and there are renters that want to be in Baltimore City. That is a fact. We see vibrant demand. So demand is not necessarily the issue. Obviously, we want to grow demand. We want it to be higher. But demand is not the ever-present issue. The ever-present issue is the effect on the housing market and on the real estate market of vacancy. the vacants have not only the effect of opportunity costs, you know, what would be better there? You know, obviously a family, a resident, occupied space would be better. So there's not only opportunity costs, there's the carrying costs, unpaid taxes, the cost of life and limb to firefighters that we have seen in the city, the cost of maintaining and boarding and keeping a registry and inspecting vacants. But then there's the externalities. And those are the things that the city is most damaged by, I think. The externalities of there not being eyes on the street, the externalities of the bad activities that can happen in those properties, the externalities of the vacant house has an effect on the value of the house next door and the house down the street. The externalities of when there are no eyes on the street, what is happening on the street? There's more crime, there's more antisocial behaviors, there's all sorts of things that the city has to then experience and take on a cost for, both, and I mean both an economic cost, a financial cost, and a social cost, and a reputational cost when they have. And so the governor has proposed a response. And that response is multifaceted, some of which are public, some of which are not yet public. But the public ones are the most, I think, the most well known so far. And they are twofold. One is saying that Project Core and the Strategic Demolition Fund under the Housing Community Development Financing Act of 2024 will be able to pay for credit enhancements and debt service so that we will be able to scale up our efforts in addressing Baltimore vacancy and other urban areas that need investment around the state with pre-development funds, which includes acquisition, stabilization, demolition, and design. And then secondly, there is a complementary budget component to this. The governor has grown by 150% the funds apportioned to Project Core in the budget. So if the General Assembly passes that, we'll now have $50 million a year for Project Core and the ability to use those funds for credit enhancements and debt service would mean we can scale it up even more. So do we have a multi-billion dollar problem in vacancy in Baltimore? Absolutely. Can we tackle that at $20 million a year? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Can we tackle it at $50 million a year, scaled up significantly through credit enhancements? Yes. And paired with an additional $27 million a year in a Baltimore Regional Neighborhoods Initiative, which is the development funding counterpart to this, I believe so. And Baltimore City is our partner in this effort. The third piece that isn't very public yet is that we are going to braid our efforts with Baltimore City so that you will see the city, the state, philanthropy, and the private sector working hand in hand for the first time.
Mm-hmm. How vital is that, all of those organizations, because we do have problems with organizations staying in their own silos, the state, the city, philanthropy, to bring all those organizations together to attack a massive problem, how big of a solution is that, and how vital is that to actually overcome something like this that has kind of overwhelmed Baltimore for a really long time?
Megan, the coordination, synchronization, and deconfliction of our efforts is the most vital part of it. We could have all the money in the world and still mess this up. And so I believe that our efforts to synchronize and deconflict precisely what is to ensure that the monies are used appropriately, efficiently, effectively, and to produce the outcomes that we are all after.
Ticket to Discovery is back at the Pratt this May. Children 5th grade and under can get a special bookmark at any Pratt location while supplies last. Read books from the reading list and earn tickets to Port Discovery Children's Museum. Find more out at prattlibrary.org.
You've delved into a lot of sort of the three-point plan for the historic housing package that's in front of the General Assembly right now. I do want to just go over it real quick so we don't miss anything, but one of the first pieces of that plan that the governor and you have set forth is really just cutting some of the government red tape when it comes to affordable housing. What does that mean, and what kind of impact could that have?
There are two real barriers to getting ourselves out of the housing affordability and supply crisis that we're in. One is addressing the financing barriers, and the second is the regulatory barriers. So what does that mean to address the regulatory barriers and cut that red tape? It means three fundamental things. Number one, that we are going to incentivize additional housing unit production. So incentivizing density for developers by adding a 30% density bonus in residential areas throughout the state, and three specific locations. Number one is within 1 mile of a fixed rail stop, a transit stop. Number two is in nonprofit-owned properties. So think our hospitals, our universities, and even churches. Number three is what I think of as the lowest hanging fruit, which is former state-owned campuses. The second way in which we incentivize or reduce those regulatory obstacles is by allowing by right manufactured and modular housing in residential areas. Now, that does not mean trailers. That means the housing that is factory built and ensuring that there are not unnecessary regulatory barriers preventing those from being built. And the third and final category is taking a hard look at the adequate public facilities ordinances of the state and saying that you cannot unreasonably use those to deny or de facto deny by affecting the viability, affordability, or density of state-financed housing developments. And just to be clear, that's about 1,500 housing units per year. So we're not talking about the majority of housing units that are produced, but we, again, want to make sure that people aren't weaponizing policies to misuse them to halt affordable housing from coming to their communities.
Mm-hmm. I know one of the second really key pieces in front of the legislature is helping really drive development by using federal support. How will that work? Who can apply for it? What does that look like, utilizing the federal dollars to support Maryland?
Yeah. So I mentioned that, again, that there were two barriers to housing production, the second being financing. And there just aren't enough dollars available in an environment where interest rates are sky high, inflation and supply chain issues have led to project costs ballooning. And so we want to make sure that we are competitive in bringing in every dollar and leveraging every state dollar for the maximum private and federal gain that we can possibly get. So the Maryland Community Investment Corporation would operate in federally designated low-income communities, which exist in nearly every county, perhaps in every county, but at least nearly every county in this state, and to help identify projects, key projects in those areas. So we'll work with communities to figure out what is it that other CDEs or community development entities have not been willing to take on? What projects didn't pencil? Where are your priorities where a developer is not willing to take it on or a CDFI is not willing to finance you? And those will be what we look at to partner and braid other resources into to try to take on. So really our desire here is to do the work that other entities have been unable to do.
Mm-hmm. One of the last pieces that you have in front of the General Assembly is a bill that would really support renters and drive down evictions. What does that look like and why is that so important?
Well, what it looks like is acknowledging that we recognize that we've got a supply problem, but that it's going to take time to build our way out of this supply problem. And so in the meantime, there are families that are being subjected to a turbulent rental market who can't rent a home to begin with and who can't transition to home ownership and who are being subjected to really unfair and oftentimes undignified and inhumane housing conditions because of that market and those conditions. So we in Maryland look at our system and say something's wrong because we have the highest rate of eviction filing in the nation. We remain an outlier and we have the lowest eviction filing fee in the nation. So we believe that there's causation there and that we need to increase the eviction filing fee. We want to create a tenant's bill of rights that is an addendum to every lease signed in the state. And oh, by the way, there are jurisdictions like the city of Salisbury that already have this. Uh-huh. And it hasn't meant there are fewer landlords or fewer rental units available. Uh-huh. It just lets people know about their rights. We would create a new Office of Tenants' Rights that would be an ombudsman for renters in the state. We would also restrict the amount that could be charged for security deposits in the state to 1 month's rent, recognizing that people can't shell out $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 like they're being expected to today in 2 months' rent up front, plus a security deposit equal to or greater than a month's rent, plus fees and application fees and credit check fees that are being piled on top of the security deposit itself. It also bans certain evictions at certain times, such as during snowstorms and hurricanes and bad weather. And then lastly, it does an important thing, which is to say that tenants will have an opportunity to purchase their properties if the landlord puts it up for sale. Doesn't mean that they get a discount or a better rate, but if it gets put up for sale, they have an opportunity to make an offer, to negotiate, and then to match any offer that comes in from a private buyer. So we think that's a great tool to help people transition to home ownership.
Mm-hmm. We're in middle of session, ending of session right now. How confident are you that the General Assembly will get behind the governor's and your initiative for housing?
I don't get a vote as much as I'd like to have one. So, you know, I trust the people who have been given that power by the voters in their communities to deliberate, to debate, and ultimately to do what they think is right. And if they do that, I think that all three of these bills are going to pass both chambers and are going to become law. My conversations with the leadership in the General Assembly, as well as members that have engaged in dialogue with me, suggests to me that we're going to end up with these three bills being law. I'm sure there will be modifications, amendments, negotiations. But I think we've made our case. I think we've made it well. I think it's been received well. And now it's really just about getting the details right.
Mm-hmm. I know we're winding down, but I'd be remiss not to mention another major initiative that your office has been focused on, and that is helping close the digital divide. I know you've worked with partners like libraries, like us, to do that. What are some of the initiatives you've been able to lead, and how are they helping connect people?
Well, the libraries have been probably the most critical partner, along with the internet service providers, in getting people connected. I believe that broadband, high-speed broadband, is the public utility to economic growth and stability and even justice that water and sewer once was. So it's so important that we get this right. We have a number of initiatives. We have been working hard to connect the last 14,000 locations in Maryland that are not connected to high-speed broadband, and the other about 14 or 15,000 underserved locations in the state. So we're trying to make sure all just under 40,000 of those locations are served and served with high-speed internet by the federal deadline in 2028. We're also finalizing getting the last of our devices out through our library and other partners in communities. And we're even working with the prisons in Maryland and our partners at the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services, as well as partners at the Department of Information Technology and Labor, to help people transition back to society in a productive way by ensuring they have access to the internet to apply for jobs and to educate themselves and to get prepared for that transition back to society. So those are some of the things we're working on. We're also working to make sure that areas with long driveways, so rural areas, and public housing and nonprofit-owned affordable housing are getting connected.
Mm-hmm. One of the last things I want to ask you is, the governor's term still very early in his term, but you guys are really proposing some changes that could be transformational changes, particularly within your office. When you look ahead 3 years, when you look ahead 7 years, what difference do you hope that you've been able to make in the state of Maryland?
When I look ahead 3 years, I hope we have changed the policy landscape on housing and created sufficient tools to produce economic change and a bright future for our cities and towns, as well as I hope we have demonstrated that we are going to invest in communities in a just way and do reparative work in the places that we have historically disinvested in or invested in and done damage. That's really important to me. And in 7 years, I hope that we have the fruits of our labor to show for it. I hope that we are no longer looking at a 96,000 unit housing shortage, but rather marching our way toward meeting demand with supply. I hope that we have completely ensured that 100% of locations in this state are connected to high-speed broadband, and that we are working on digital literacy and fluency as the next frontier of ensuring that everyone benefits from the internet and the digital economy. And I hope that we are dramatically changing the landscape in Baltimore City and core communities around the state with catalytic revitalization and redevelopment projects, and have significantly reduced the number of vacants in the city and in other core urban neighborhoods. That's the Maryland that I hope we have as a result of our work in 3 and 7 years.
Uh-huh. Well, Secretary Jake Day, thank you so much for taking the time.
It's been a pleasure. I hope I get to do this again.
Need housing assistance? Visit a housing navigator at select Enoch Pratt Free Library locations. In partnership with the Mayor's Office of Homeless Services, Housing Navigators provide assistance with finding stable housing, education, and advocacy. More details at prattlibrary.org.
I'm Megan McCorkle, and you've been listening to the Free to Be More podcast by the Enoch Pratt Free Library. You can follow the Pratt on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join me next month for another Free to Be More conversation. Thanks for listening.